From NPR News, this is special coverage of the 2012 Republican National Convention. I'm Jennifer Ludden. We'll be taking you live to Tampa for the second night of this convention, an important evening for Vice Presidential candidate Paul Ryan. He's the keynote speaker, and this is the biggest stage the telegenic Tea Party favorite will have since his debut as Mitt Romney's running mate. Mr. Ryan is best known as the chief architect of the Republican Party's plan for tax cuts and spending cuts, and an advocate of reshaping the Medicare program that provides health insurance for older Americans. Mitt Romney's choice put the size and role of the federal government squarely at the center of this presidential campaign, and we can expect to hear more about it over the course of the evening. I'm joined by NPR Washington editor Ron Elving. He's with us from the convention hall in Tampa, along with E.J. Dion of the Washington Post and Brookings Institution. Hello there.
How are you?
Good. And here with me in Studio 3A is Matt Continetti of the Washington Free Beacon. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Ron, let me start with you. This is Paul Ryan's debut, in a way, tonight to the larger American audience. What can we expect?
We can expect him to talk primarily about economics, primarily about how he wants to save Medicare, which will be the language I believe they will use. And we should expect him to talk a little bit about how he thinks his plan would eventually put the United States back on a positive economic basis.
Okay. Matt Continetti, when Romney made this choice of Paul Ryan, both Republicans and Democrats said, great, that's what we wanted. So who was right?
Well, I think the Republicans were right, and actually both sides may have been right. But if you just look at the polls, we have seen a tightening in the polls since the Ryan selection, both nationally and in some swing states such as Wisconsin and Michigan. So I think so far the Ryan pick has been playing out pretty well for the Romney campaign. Tonight is a big moment. It is Ryan's real introduction to the entire country. He's very popular among conservatives like myself here in Washington, D.C. He's enthusiastically received by the base. He's been receiving a lot of big audiences in these rallies that he's been attending. The question is, how does he come across on TV? I think he'll come across pretty well.
E.J. Dion, Democrats have been happy to have Ryan out there. Might they change their mind tonight?
I don't think they will. I think the feeling on the part of Democrats is that Ryan's budget is so extreme that if the details of it are vetted by the public, they're going to say, we don't want to go here, particularly his proposals on taxes, which would leave Mitt Romney, by the way, paying less than 1% in income taxes. He's got a very big task tonight because, as Matt suggested, he's well-known inside the Beltway. He's well-known among certain parts of the Republican base. He's not well-known to most Americans. And so for an awful lot of people, to the extent that they are watching this convention, this will be their first introduction to him. And so I'm going to be curious, how much does he talk about his own ideology? I think he won't talk about it very much. And how much does he talk about his biography? I think he'll be talking about that a lot. But how does he choose to present himself? He can't present himself as a poor boy because he wasn't a poor boy. He did lose his dad at 16, which we will probably hear about. But I think it's a very important intro for him.
All right. Well, at the podium now is Senator John McCain. He, of course, was the party's nominee 4 years ago in 2008. He's the only former party nominee speaking tonight. Ron Elving, as we prepare to listen to John McCain, what does it mean for him to be there tonight?
It is the one nod that is being made to the past in terms of the better speaking positions, the primetime speaking positions. He is the only, as you said, the only nominee from the past who is speaking tonight, although we did have a brief tribute video to the two George Bushes who sat down together and talked a little bit about
their
presidency.
All right, and let's listen now. Senator John McCain in Tampa.
We are now being tested by an array of threats that are more complex, more numerous, and just as deeply and deadly as I can recall in my lifetime. We face a consequential choice, and make no mistake, it is a choice. We can choose to follow a declining path toward a future that is dimmer and more dangerous than our past. Or we can choose to reform our failing government, revitalize our ailing economy, and renew the foundations of our power and leadership in the world. That is what's at stake in this election. Unfortunately, for four years, we've drifted away from our proudest traditions of global leadership, traditions that are truly bipartisan. We've let the challenges we face both at home and abroad become much harder to solve. We can't afford to stay on that course any longer. We can't afford to cause our friends and allies from Latin America to Europe to Asia to the Middle East, and especially in Israel, a nation under existential threat, to doubt America's leadership. We can't afford to give governments in Russia and China a veto over how we defend our interests and the progress of our values in the world. We can't afford to have the security of our nation. We can't afford to have the security of our nation and those who bravely defend it endangered because their government leaks the secrets of their heroic operations to the media. I believe we can't afford to substitute a political timetable for a military strategy. By committing to withdraw from Afghanistan before peace can be achieved and sustained, the President has discouraged our friends and emboldened our enemies, which is why our commanders did not recommend these decisions and why they have said it puts our mission at much greater risk. We can't afford another $500 billion in cuts in our defense budget on top of the nearly $500 billion in cuts that the President is already making. His own Secretary of Defense has said that cutting our military by nearly $1 trillion would be devastating. And yet, the President is playing no leadership role in preventing this crippling blow to our military. A wise congressman from Wisconsin has said, "Our fiscal policy and our foreign policy are on a collision course." And that man is our next Vice President, Paul Ryan. But most of all, we can't afford to abandon the cause of human freedom. When long-suffering peoples demand liberation from their jailers and torturers and tyrants, the leader of the free world must stand with them. Unfortunately, this is not happening. When Iranians rose up by the millions against their oppressive rulers, when they besieged our president, chanting in English, "Are you with us or are you with them?" When the entire world watched as a brave young woman named Netta was shot and bled to death in the street in Tehran, the president missed an historic opportunity to throw America's full moral support behind an Iranian revolution that shared one of our highest interests, ridding Iran of a brutal dictatorship that terrorized the Middle East and threatens the world. The situation is far worse in Syria. What began as peaceful protests has now become, 18 months later, a savage and unfair fight. With the full backing of Iran and Hezbollah and Russia, with tanks and helicopters and fighter jets, Bashar Assad is murdering men, women, and children. More than 20,000 people have perished. Extremists are gaining ground, and the conflict is becoming more dangerous by the day for our allies and for us. In other times, when other courageous people fought for their freedom against sworn enemies of the United States, American presidents, both Republicans and Democrats, have acted to help them prevail. Sadly, Sadly for the lonely voices of dissent in Syria and Iran and elsewhere in the world who feel forgotten in their darkness, and sadly for us as well, our president is not being true to our values. For the sake of the cause of freedom, for the sake of people who are willing to give their lives so their fellow citizens can determine their own futures, and for the sake of our nation, the nation founded on the idea that all people everywhere have the right to freedom and justice, we must return to our best traditions of American leadership and support those who face down the brutal tyranny of their oppressors and our enemies. My friends, across the world, people are seizing control of their own destinies. They are liberating themselves from oppressive rulers, and they want America's support. They want America's assistance as they struggle to live in peace and security, to expand opportunity for themselves and their children, to replace the injustices of despots with the institutions of democracy and freedom. America must be on the right side of history. The demand for our leadership in the world has never been greater. People don't want less of America. They want more. Everywhere I go in the world, people tell me that they still have faith in America. What they want to know is whether we still have faith in ourselves. I trust that Mitt Romney has that faith, and I trust him to lead us. I trust him to affirm our nation's exceptional character and responsibilities. I trust him to know that our security and economic interests are inextricably tied to the progress of our values. I trust him to know that if America doesn't lead, our adversaries will. And the world will go darker, poorer, and much more dangerous. I trust him to know that an American president always, always, always stands up for the rights and freedoms and justice of all people. I trust Mitt Romney to know that good can triumph over evil, that justice can vanquish tyranny, that love can conquer hate, that the desire for freedom is eternal and universal, and that America is still the best hope of mankind. And now, my fellow Americans, let's elect our next commander-in-chief and the next leader of the free world, my friend, Governor Mitt Romney.
And that was Arizona Senator John McCain, the Republican presidential nominee from 2008, in his speech in Tampa there live before the Republican National Convention. Mr. McCain talked about the U.S. having drifted away from global leadership. He criticized President Obama's proposed cuts to defense, and he criticized the president for not helping anti-government protesters in Iran and insurgents in Syria. Ron Elving, 4 years ago, national security was such a big issue in the presidential campaign. It's really not been one now. What happened?
Well, I've just been struck by that very fact myself. Not only 4 years ago, but 8 years ago, national security, the war against terrorism, were just the biggest issues that the Republicans had to talk about, and we talked about them almost constantly in New York in 2004. 4 years after that, perhaps we were beginning to be distracted by some of the problems the economy was having, but it was still a huge focus for the Republican convention. I couldn't help but notice in the last 10, 15 minutes that the audience was barely paying attention to John McCain's speech, and perhaps you could even hear in the in the ambient sound behind John McCain that the audience was not responding very much to what he had to say, except when he criticized President Obama. But there was not the sense that these were important issues that we would have had in the past. Clearly, historically, the situations in the Middle East have become more complicated. They're more difficult for most Americans to understand. We don't see them strictly in terms of 9/11 anymore. And so Syria and Iran are much more difficult questions than Afghanistan and Iraq might have been 4 or 8 years ago.
Matt Cotinetti, Mr. Obama's foreign policy is often noted for its similarity to his predecessor, President Bush. What are the key differences between his foreign policy and Mitt Romney's?
Well, I think defense cuts are one. I mean, Obama hasn't really done much to stop the coming sequester that was agreed to as part of last year's budget control.
The sequester means automatic cuts to defense.
That's right, about
if there's
$500
not a budget
billion
agreement.
In defense cuts. And Romney says he'd repeal that, much like he says he'd repeal Obama's cuts to Medicare. I want to take issue with one thing Ron said, which was there was one big foreign policy applause line in McCain's speech. And that was when McCain mentioned Israel. And I think on that issue, there is some clear differences between Romney and Obama in how you approach Israel and the state of America's relationship with Israel. And Israel has become a values issue. It's not only something that I think could swing some swing voters in Florida and other Jewish voters, but also it moves evangelical conservatives who are the base of the party. This is an issue that connects with their hearts, and I think you'll see a lot of the speakers, when they mention foreign policy tonight, they'll mention America's relationship with Israel.
E.J. Dion, foreign policy is something that Mr. Obama polls well on, but Israel is seen as a weak spot.
That's true, although I think the issue, he's going to carry the Jewish vote, President Obama is. The issue is, does he lose ground on the 78% that he got the last time? But I think on the larger point, one of the things worth noting is they put John McCain on the stage talking about foreign policy a little after 8 o'clock this evening. They did not put him in the 10 o'clock hour. And I think it's very clear that this party is not as engaged in foreign policy. And they know that Bush foreign policy is broadly unpopular now, and that Obama's foreign policy, which is more like the first President Bush's than the second President Bush's, is rather popular. One other thing on that, Rand Paul spoke earlier, Senator Rand Paul, which I thought was important to Romney because he endorsed Romney, and the Ron Paul delegates for his dad are pretty alienated. But he said to Cheers, we can't sacrifice liberty for security. If those words had been spoken at a Republican convention in 2004 or 2008, they would have been booed and they were cheered at this convention.
All right. Well, we'll have more coming up in just a few moments. Live coverage of the 2012 Republican National Convention from NPR News.
Support for NPR's election coverage comes from Nissan, featuring the redesigned Nissan Altima with 38 miles per gallon highway. Nissan, innovation that excites. From CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight nearly 500 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce fuel consumption. CSX, how tomorrow moves. And from America's Natural Gas Alliance, supplying domestic energy while working to protect the environment. Learn more at anga.us. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is special coverage of the 2012 Republican National Convention. I'm Jennifer Ludden. One of the underlying tensions in these past 2 days has been some disputes between supporters of former presidential candidate Ron Paul and some of the rulemakers there at the convention. I think Brian Naylor, NPR's Brian Naylor, is on the floor with more on that. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Jennifer. Yeah, I'm in the Texas delegation, which has been one of the hot spots of support for Congressman Paul, who, of course, is from Texas. And I'm with alternate delegate Chris Haley from Dallas. Chris, you were a bound delegate to Mitt Romney, but you were a Ron Paul supporter. What are your thoughts about what happened in these past couple of days in terms of the rule changes and what's happened to Ron Paul's delegates?
Well, the rule changes, of course, are very bad. We were against them. The way that they were treated by the RNC, by Priebus, was extremely unfair. Everyone saw it. Everyone knows it. So in that regard, it's very bad. However, I think it's been a positive gain for us because it helped all of the other delegates here who are not Paul supporters to see the way that we have been treated by the RNC for so long. And people, no matter what they think about Paul, don't like cheating. And I think that's gained a lot of sympathy for us and helped to grow the cause.
I've noticed a lot of folks wearing stickers that say, "Remember Maine 2012.
Yes,
Maine
sir.
was the state where Paul supporters say that they won that state. They had the majority of the delegates, and yet they weren't seated here.
They did. They won. They won their elections fair and square, and they were stripped by the RNC. Many of us, especially here in Texas, have worked hard to get those delegates seated again. We wrote petitions. Tried to make an order, make a motion following all of the rules. We were shut down and ignored. These people worked very hard in their state. They spent a lot of money to come here. They were duly elected. The errors, which are nothing compared to the errors that we've seen in this convention, were not things that were done by those delegates. So it's a very sad story for them.
This. What does this mean, Chris, for Paul's supporters? After the way you feel you've been treated here, what does this do for chances of supporting Mitt Romney?
That's going to be an individual question for most people. Some Paul supporters will support him. Some won't. Many won't.
In favor of whom?
Either not voting at all or perhaps the Libertarian candidate, Gary Johnson.
Do you consider yourself in any of those categories?
I'm a thorough Paul supporter. I'm thoroughly opposed also to Barack Obama having a second term. I'm undecided at this point, given the way this convention has gone, how I'll vote in November. But it will not be for Barack Obama.
One last question. We heard tonight earlier from Senator Rand Paul, Ron Paul's son, also very libertarian in his views. Do you see him as carrying the mantle, the Paulist libertarian mantle forward?
In many ways, a lot of the Ron Paul supporters definitely group behind Rand Paul as well. They would both be the first people to tell you that they're not the same person. He's not trying to carry on his father's legacy. His father never urged him to go into politics, and we know that. We know Rand is very different. But we know also that he grew up under his father's teaching, that he's as steeped in Austrian economics and free market principles and individual liberty as anyone. So we have a great trust and confidence in him.
Thanks very much. That's alternate delegate Chris Haley from Dallas, Texas, here in the Texas delegation. Jennifer, back to you in Washington.
Thanks, Brian Naylor. In a moment, we're going to go back to the podium live in Tampa. We're going to hear Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi speak, along with Sam Olens. He's the Georgia Attorney General. Right now, I'm back with NPR's Ron Elving and E.J. Dion of the Washington Post, and also Matt Continente of the Washington Free Beacon. Matt, how important is this dispute between Ron Paul's supporters and the new rules that have been approved yesterday?
I think it rates pretty low on the list of priorities.
You had not just Ron Paul, though. You had some Tea Party activists, Freedom Works, which has really boosted the Tea Party, got in on the complaining. Sarah Palin tweeted about this.
Jennifer, it's a stretch to say that conventions matter anymore, much less the intranecine disputes occurring at the conventions.
The concern that this fresh air of the grassroots activists will be squashed, you're not worried.
I just don't think it will factor that much in the vote in November.
All right.
Could I express a different view?
Sure, E.J. Dion.
Surprisingly, E.J. differs.
Yeah, right, exactly. No, I mean, as a matter of democratic theory, actually, there's a case to be made for changing the rule because delegates should reflect the results of the primary. There's actually a plausible case for what they did. However, this was experienced by Ron Paul supporters as the Romney machine squashing grassroots activism. They did get these delegates by doing a lot of work and showing up at all these meetings. And if this is a close election, they don't want to lose Ron Paul votes to a libertarian third-party candidate or to non-participation. And so I don't think they handled it very well. And so in a close race, it could have some effect. Having said all that, conventions don't matter like they used to. I agree with Matt on that.
And Ron Elving, this is your what convention? How many have you been to?
15. This is my 15th. And
really?
I would say that they have declined in importance pretty much on a straight line. This is nothing like the kind of convention where they made the decision as to who would be the nominee or who would be the vice presidential nominee or what the platform would consist of. Everything is just a ratification of what was decided somewhere else. And these rule disputes, which are relatively minor in the great history of convention rule disputes and credential disputes, are minor because they're really not only going to be forgotten in the fight over this year's nomination, but they'll probably be messed with and changed again before we get to 2016, and it will only be another ratification in 2016. So what these have become, as we've said before, is essentially multi-night advertisements on primetime television and on cable television for the ticket and for the ideas of each party. Each one of them is very much the same, Republican and Democrat.
All right. Well, moving ahead now, we're about to hear from Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi. It's a big turn in the spotlight for her. She's young, seen as charismatic. Ron, just sticking with you a moment, can you tell us a bit about her?
You know, she is in many senses the soul as well as the image of the battle against Obamacare in the minds of American conservatives. She was one of the very first, if not the very first, to come out and say, we're going to sue and we're going to resist this in every way we can because, you know, it's been passed by Congress and signed into law by the president, but we don't really think that it's going to be constitutional and therefore we don't think we need to comply with it. They have run into a bit of a wall. The Supreme Court now has ruled close, 5-4, but nonetheless decisively that Obamacare is constitutional. And that the challenge that was brought to it by all these attorneys general in the states was not a valid challenge. That leaves them with very few options other than to begin at least to comply with the law and try to resist it between now and January when they hope to have another president who would grant waivers to any state and every state that wished to have them.
Right. Matt Continetti, remind us what Mr. Romney has said he would do. Regarding so-called Obamacare.
Well, he'd repeal it. And I think that's been a strong part of his platform and also a major point of his appeal to conservatives. Obamacare was a huge issue in 2010, and it offends the conservative coalition in so many different ways that Republicans would be really amiss if they don't attack Obamacare again in 2012.
Although we're not sure how easy it would all be done away with. Let's go to the stage in Tampa now. Pam Bondi, the Attorney General of Florida.
Driven to exercise government power over
She's
our
being
freedoms,
introduced here.
Our rights, and our lives. We know that the Constitution limits federal power, but President Obama clearly believes those limits just get in his way. So he ignores them time and again. He promises to rescue our economy.
All right, this
and
is Sam Olens. He's the Attorney General of Georgia. Jobs. He's on stage in Tampa alongside Pam Bondi of Florida, two attorney generals who brought suit
he
against the Affordable
to have the most
Care
transparent
Act.
Administration in history, but now refuses to come clean with Congress and the American people about fast and furious.
He sure does. He talks about giving us more control over health care decisions, but instead grants that power to government bureaucrats. He claims that government is responsible for private sector success, but the only thing he is building is bigger government. And Obamacare is Exhibit A.
It distorts our Constitution and endangers our fragile economy. We did everything in our power to stop it, taking the fight all the way to the United States Supreme Court. We prevailed on our two main arguments.
The court agreed that the Commerce Clause of the Constitution does not allow the federal government to purchase a product to force you to purchase something that you do not want. The court agreed that the Constitution does not allow the federal government to force states to adopt a budget-busting expansion of Medicaid.
Then came the shocker. The Supreme Court upheld the individual insurance mandate by calling it something the president swore it never was, a tax. At every stage of the process, President Obama and congressional Democrats promised us that the mandate was not a tax, because they knew Americans were hurting, and the last thing we needed was another tax. Because they knew if the American public were told that Obamacare was just a massive tax hike, they wouldn't have a prayer of passing it.
Right. Instead, President Obama and the Democrats called it a mandate. Then they turned around and, without a shred of shame, asked the court to call the mandate a tax. Yet the president can't bring himself to acknowledge publicly that the only reason this unaffordable CARE Act still stands is because it is a tax. This is what happens when a president has such total disregard for our individual liberty that he knowingly and purposely imposes unwarranted restrictions against the will of the people. This is not why our founding fathers risked their lives and their fortunes when they created a nation. This is not why young American men and women today risk their lives in defense of freedom. So tonight, we ask you, do you want skyrocketing health insurance premiums?
Do you want enormous new financial burdens on young people who already shoulder our nation's crushing debt?
Do you want the government to force individuals and religious institutions to violate the tenets of their faith?
Do you want over $1 trillion in new tax increases?
Do you want a job-destroying insurance mandate that strangles our businesses?
Do you want a federal government that tells you what to do, what to think, or what to buy when it comes to your health care?
Do you want the federal government to steal hundreds of billions of dollars from Medicare to hide the true cost of Obamacare?
Do you want more of this for four more years? The health care lawsuit has reminded all of us that the Constitution limits the power of government. It has reminded us of the precious relationship between federalism and individual liberty. And though we fundamentally disagree with his decision, Chief Justice Roberts did observe that it is not the Supreme Court's job to protect the people from the consequences of their political choices.
That's right. It is our job to make a new choice. It is time to stand up and say, in a loud, clear voice, enough. It is time to repeal Obamacare. It is time to stop those who ignore the Constitution when it's expedient. It is time to remember that our rights are not a gift from government, but from God, and that by His grace, we will defend them. It is time for Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan. Thank you. Have a great night.
All right, and in a duet there in Tampa, that was Pam Bondi, Attorney General of Florida, and Sam Olens, Attorney General of Georgia, two of the attorney generals who filed suit against the Affordable Care Act. And on the floor of the convention in Tampa, we have NPR's Jeff Brady. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. I'm with the Massachusetts delegation, and I'm sitting here with with Senator Bruce Tarr. He is the minority leader in the Massachusetts Senate. And now you supported the health care overhaul in Massachusetts. You're not a big fan of the national health care overhaul. Tell me why.
Well, I'm not, because actually what's being passed nationally would have thwarted what we tried to do in Massachusetts by tailoring a plan that would work for our individual state to be able to use Medicaid money with more creativity and more efficiency. And we didn't try to use federal Medicare money to cross-subsidize our Medicaid population. So the elements that have made the Massachusetts plan successful would have been impeded significantly, if not completely obstructed, by the federal law if we were trying to do it today.
Well, I think a lot of us have heard that what Massachusetts did is very similar to what President Obama tried to do nationally. So why would you have a problem with that?
Because what President Obama did nationally was a one-size-fits-all that doesn't allow states the flexibility that we had. And in fact, part of what made our law work were waivers from the federal government on how to use Medicaid dollars more effectively. What's coming out of the federal government under the plan that President Obama has passed is actually a requirement that states won't be able to get Medicaid money at all if they don't follow the dictates of the federal government. So it's completely antithetical to what we did in Massachusetts under Governor Romney.
So can you give me one brief example of a problem that that creates for you in Massachusetts?
Well, one of the issues is that we have a number of hospitals that carry a disproportionate share of Medicaid patients that we need to compensate so that they can make up for the losses they have of not being reimbursed enough for those patients. That was done through a Medicaid waiver. That Medicaid waiver is going away, and in 2014, a number of those hospitals are fearful they're going to lose millions of dollars, and their very survival is going to be threatened. So what we have and what's working very, very well in Massachusetts in many respects is directly threatened by what's happening under the federal law.
That's Senator Bruce Tarr. He is the minority leader of the Massachusetts Senate, a fan of Massachusetts overhaul, but not a big fan of what has become known as Obamacare. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Jeff Brady. Ron Elving, Mitt Romney has suggested that pretty much on day one, if elected, he would repeal Obamacare. But realistically, what could a new president and a new Congress do?
It depends largely on what kind of Senate he has. If he has clear Republican control of the Senate, perhaps he can repeal it very early on in the very earliest days. It would take a few days. It couldn't be done on the very first day. But they could do it as quickly as possible, and I think they would work very hard to make that very quick. So that is possible if he has a really strong control of the Senate. More likely, the Senate is going to be very closely divided. It could even remain in Democratic hands. In that event, it's going to be difficult to pass legislation repealing repealing Obamacare, because the Senate could have another filibuster led by Democrats the way it's had so many led by Republicans the last few years. So that is a little bit more difficult. As an alternative to repeal, there is the prospect of granting waivers across the board to any state that wants to have one. And we would be, in my guess, seeing a number of states ask for waivers immediately on Inauguration Day, and President Romney, if he were to be the president, granting many of those waivers as quickly as he could.
E.J. Dionne, the president has been accused repeatedly of not making a strong case for his health care law. In just a few seconds, is he campaigning effectively for why people should vote to keep it?
I think that Democrats around the country are starting to campaign on the things the law does that people like. And I could list all of them, like not having being able to insure your kids under 26, not being able to be discriminated against for pre-existing conditions. I think you're going to have a defense of it this year.
All right. More is coming up, and the big keynote speaker later this evening, Vice Presidential candidate Paul Ryan. Stay tuned. You're listening to special coverage of the 2012 Republican National Convention from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is special coverage of the 2012 Republican National Convention. I'm Jennifer Ludden. It's the second night of the convention. We've had a bit of stagecraft at the Republican convention this evening. Attorneys General Pam Bond and Sam Olens engaged in a give-and-take duet there at the podium as they mounted a full-blown attack on President Obama's Affordable Care Act. In a moment, Senator John Thune will take the poem. He's one of the many speakers tonight whose name was bandied about as a possible number two for Romney. Now, let's go to former Governor Jim Gilmore. He's also a former chairman of the RNC, and he's down on the convention floor in Tampa. Welcome to you.
Good. Thank you very much.
So as a former head of the Republican National Convention, can I ask you about this tension we've talked about, that the rules changes between that the Ron Paul supporters and Tea Party activists have really criticized, saying it stifles the grassroots just when they're bringing real energy into the party. What do you make of how the RNC handled that?
Gee, that's a really great question. I've talked to delegates on the floor who would have been much happier if there had not been a rule change like that. And I think that it opens up a political issue that within the Republican Party about how we're going to manage our affairs. But I don't think any of your listeners ought to be really confused by a matter like that. This convention and these candidates are all about the real issue of how we're going to get Americans back to work, create more jobs, get more revenue flowing in, get a more dynamic economy so that people can get back into real jobs, young people can find careers. And they're focused like a laser beam on that. So I think you're going to see some give and take in the party, and I've seen a lot of that over my lifetime, but I don't think it's going to distract us from the central point on behalf of the American people.
Okay. On a more general level, though, how do you think the party should go about, you know, maintaining its traditional base but also welcoming this new input of the Tea Party? We hear about, some of the tensions between them, but really, if you're going to make a bigger tent, what's the best way to accommodate both there?
You know, I've always believed the Republican Party can be a big tent. And we have a lot of disparate groups that are coming into our process and coming into our conventions and being elected. Tea Party people, Ron Paul people, lots of additional groups are coming into our party. And I think that we need to even go further. I think we need to really reach out into the African-American community. When I ran for governor, I got 20% of the African-American vote. I think I know how to do that. And I think that's what our party ought to do. And in addition to that, it's not too late for us to reach out into the Hispanic community and talk about not only our families and our faith, but frankly, they're here for jobs and opportunity. They're here for the same things that we're here for here in Tampa. So I'm really looking forward to broadening the base of the party as time goes on.
All right. We've talked about national security some because we just heard from the party's former candidate from 4 years ago, John McCain. It was kind of the first time this convention that national security was talked about a lot. The issue seems to have all but disappeared this campaign. What do you think happened?
I think that the overpowering concern of the American people right now is for the issue of their economic well-being in the future and for that of their families and for that of their children. And that's why you're not hearing as much about national security. I happen to have a passion for national security. I think that there are troubled times ahead in the next number of years. And I could go into all that with you, but I think there are really real issues ahead of us. And I will tell you, it's not going to be possible for us to have the same kind of authority and influence in the 21st century unless we build up our economy. It's the American economy with our jobs, our manufacturing, our opportunities, the excitement of our free enterprise system and the wonderful chance to actually gain some wealth and independence. These are the things that in the end translate into the power to have a national influence and a good defense for the American people.
All right. Lastly, you were the governor of Virginia, so it was big news 4 years ago when that state turned blue and went for President Obama. Is it in play this year?
Oh, yeah, it sure is. And I think that we've got to really make our case. The people of Virginia are a microcosm of the people of the United States. We have everybody and everything in Virginia. It's a very big state and a very sophisticated state, and people are watching their politics closely. Our job is to make the case, explain to Virginians, and frankly to all Americans, why our approaches are superior to that of President Obama's. It's clear that President Obama's approaches have not worked. Now we have to explain to the American people that they have a chance with us, a real chance for change to actually do things in a better way.
All right. Thank you so very much. Governor Jim Gilmore, former chairman of the Republican National Committee and former governor of Virginia, we appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. A pleasure to be talking to your listeners.
All right, and we're back now with NPR's Ron Elving, E.J. Dion of the Washington Post and Brookings Institution, and Matt Continetti of the Washington Free Beacon. Governor Gilmore just spoke about his desire to bring more communities of color into the GOP, and yet, Ron Elving, is it a pretty white convention down there this year?
It is, in terms of most of the members of most of the delegations. When you see the stage, you will see a great deal more variety. You'll see a number of Hispanic people brought to the stage, as last night we had 10 featured women speakers. Several of them were Hispanic. Mia Love, the mayor of Saratoga Springs, Utah, an African-American woman and a very powerful speaker and high-voltage personality. Was one of the featured speakers during the day. And we will see later on tonight Condoleezza Rice speaking. And, of course, she was the first African-American woman to be Secretary of State in a Republican administration, one should add. And there are a number of featured people here who are of color. But the general population of the floor and of the attendees and the alternates is pretty overwhelmingly Anglo, and that is the nature primarily of the Republican vote. And that is an issue because the number of Anglo voters nationally, which was once 90% not too long ago in the 80s, is now down around 75%. So if you drop from 90% Anglo vote to 75% Anglo vote, you're going to need to get an awfully large percentage of the Anglo vote to offset the people of color who are voting more predominantly Democratic. So this is a political imperative for Republicans. As Governor Gilmore was saying, it's necessary for them not necessarily to win every different ethnic group, every different racial group, but they need to be well represented among every group, especially as the minorities grow.
Matt Continetti.
Well, I was just going to say, as an Irish Italian, I take offense to Ron's labeling of the white vote as Anglo. And to say it's not, the white voters are not just Anglos, Ron. We come from all sorts. No, I think I largely agree with that analysis. I think what we've seen as the Democratic Party has become more reliant on the minority vote, the Republican Party has become more reliant on the white vote. And what that means is that Republicans have to rack up big, big margins, 20-point margins plus among the white vote in order to win national elections. Now, that's what they did in 2010. The question in 2012 is, will the electorate be more like that of 2010 or more like that of 2008? And if it's somewhere in between, we're going to have a very close election.
E.J. Dion, you want to weigh in on this issue?
Yeah, not so fast, Matt. Although I must say I am a French-Canadian American, so we are diverse here. I wanted to say that the two parties are not similar on this. 61% of Obama's vote came from whites, but he overwhelmed John McCain among African Americans. Not surprisingly, the first African American president, McCain got about 3%. That's down from 11% that George Bush got. But the big regression was among Latinos, where Bush got somewhere upwards of 40% of the Latino vote, and McCain was down to, I think, the high 30s the last time. The low 30s the last time, and Romney's in the 20s. So Republicans are becoming very nearly an all-white party at the electoral level, and that's a real problem for them. And incidentally, it wasn't McCain's fault that he lost Latino votes. He really did a lot on immigration. It was what was happening in the Congress. So the Republicans have a lot of steps to take, and this convention hall is very much not a convention hall full of minorities other than the various kinds of white minorities, including the Irish and the Italians and the French-Canadians.
Let's not forget our Scandinavian-Americans.
Yes, oh, yes.
John Mr. Thune was just speaking as a Norwegian-American.
Exactly. As a matter of fact, John Thune with the bluest eyes of any...
If we go on like this, we will offend every listener we have.
That seems to be our apparent goal.
All right. Can I just throw in something completely randomly here? We heard from Senator John McCain earlier. I've been told it's his birthday today. He is 76. So I guess it's an okay way to spend it. Ron, minorities, I guess females are not a minority. They're 53% of voters, but it's another place where the GOP has a bit of a gap there. Ann Romney last night made an impassioned appeal to women, and as you've mentioned, we've heard a lot of women speakers, especially last night. The party's clearly trying to close its gender gap. Do you think that this week will help them?
Yes, I think it's going to be a step in the right direction. I think that they're doing positive things to show that they care about women's voters, women's votes, and also, to some degree, about women's leadership. They're showing not just women, but women who are either in positions of great authority, senators, governors, but people who are running for those offices, and they're showing how much they approve of that and how much they want to have women champion Republican causes. Now, at the same time, they are not making any adjustments that I can see to their platform from 4 years ago. If anything, their platform is moving away from the positions on women's issues of interest that are expressed by most women. Now, of course, there are women who feel very strongly that abortion should be illegal, including in all cases. But by and large, the vote among women, or the opinion among women, is more pro-choice than it is among men. And, or, excuse me, let's put it more precisely, women are more likely to be concerned about the restriction of choice and then not be concerned about that. And so this is an issue, and there are other issues as well, gay marriage, also equal pay, and some of the other issues that women have expressed a particular interest in, spending for social issues. All of these things the Republican Party moves away from when it writes its platform.
All right, NPR's Ron Elving with E.J. Dionne and Matt Continenti will come back to you. Right now, we're going to go to the floor there of the convention hall in Tampa. NPR's Brian Naylor is there. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Jennifer. I'm in the Ohio delegation, which is right in front of the stage and right in front of the band. So
we can hear it there.
That's good. Yeah, I can hear you. And I'm with Delegate Nancy Suhadolnik from Strongsville, Ohio.
Yes.
And that's near Cleveland.
Right.
Okay. You guys have a front and center location here. I guess it has something to do with the importance of Ohio this year as one of the prime battleground states.
Ohio has always been the most important state because it's so close. Our races are within vote, and we can make a difference in Ohio. Every vote counts.
Now, we're waiting to hear from your senator, Rob Portman, who's going to be speaking in just a few minutes. He was one of those that was on the short list, it was thought, to be Mitt Romney's running mate. I'm wondering, are you disappointed that he didn't get the call?
We were very excited because he was very close to being the vice president candidate, and that was very exciting. He's a fabulous guy. We're extremely proud of him. We want to make him the senior senator from Ohio by replacing... what's his name? Sherrod Brown with Josh Mandel. That's a good point. And he's a fabulous guy. We totally respect him. He's going to lead in the rehearsal for the debates, too.
He's going to, Ron Portman is. He's going to play the part of
Obama.
President Obama. I'm wondering what you think. Ohio is a state where manufacturing is very important, and manufacturing has made a comeback. The unemployment rate has declined a little bit. Those are all things that Governor Kasich was talking about last
night.
Things that it would seem would also help President Obama as he runs for re-election this year in Ohio. What is it going to take for Mitt Romney to win Ohio?
We are working on the grassroots, and we're working so hard, and every vote counts, and we're doing the best we can because the jobs and the economy are so important. And Governor Kasich is doing absolutely the best he can to make a difference. And even with all the policies that Obama is putting out there, the unemployment is still way too high.
Romney has made several stops, I know, in Ohio.
He'll be back.
There are a lot of blue-collar, working-class voters in Ohio, voters the type that it's said that Governor Romney has difficulty connecting with. Do you see that?
Actually, I'm from the Cleveland area, and we had Reagan Democrats from Parma, and I'm hoping they'll come back.
What is it going to take? I mean, is Mitt Romney making that connection now?
I believe so, yes.
And is there... Brian Naylor, I think we're going to take it from there. Can you thank your guests for us so much?
All right.
Up next, yay!
Thanks very much.
Very much. Very, very good.
NPR's Brian Naylor on the floor there with the band. I can't see which band it is. There's a lot of entertainment down in Tampa. We're here with Matt Continenti, E.J. Dionne, and Ron Elving. Where does Ohio stand right now, Matt?
Well, Ohio has actually been in the Obama column for some time, and actually it's worrisome if from the Romney camp point of view, because the numbers there have been pretty stable. There's been some slight closing, in particular in the Senate race that the guest mentioned between Josh Mandel, this baby-faced young ex-Marine, and the state treasurer versus incumbent Senator Sherrod Brown. But Romney has not been very competitive in Ohio recently, and he needs to pull that together. You know, no Republican wins the presidency without Ohio, so it's a crucial state.
E.J. Dionne, does Paul Ryan on the ticket help Romney in Ohio, being from such a nearby state?
I don't think particularly. The delegate mentioned Parma, a classic kind of blue-collar suburb outside of Cleveland. I actually visited Parma during the primary, and what really struck me is that one-time homeland for Reagan Democrats seems to be drifting back Democratic. And we talked last night about the power of the attack by John Kasich and the Republicans on collective bargaining rights. Parma was a town where the unions are still strong, and they turned out an extraordinary vote to rebuke the governor on that. And I think the mood there is still like that. And so, as Matt suggested, Obama has had a surprisingly durable lead there. The Senate race, Sherrod Brown would not be in trouble, but for millions and millions of dollars in outside money for third-party ads because of Citizens United. That's the race to watch to see how much impact the outside money has.
Ron Elving, last night we heard from John Kasich, Ohio's governor, who basically was talking about how good things are going in the state, which would not bode well for Mr. Romney this campaign if he's talking about how bad the economy is.
It is a bit of a contradiction for these Republican governors. They want to take credit for how well things are going in their state where that is the case, and they also don't want to share any of that credit with President Obama. Now, in the case of Ohio, where the auto industry support that the Obama administration provided seems to have made quite a difference to their economy and their recovery, they've got a better unemployment rate than most states. Now, is that because of the auto industry support and some of the Obama policies, or is it because some of the things that John Kasich has done since he became governor have had an effect? That's a tough one to parse out, even for people who live there and do it for a living. So it's going to come down to what the voters feel and what kind of arguments the presidential candidates can make. Some people are going to remember that Mitt Romney was against helping the auto industry a couple, 3 years ago, at least in the manner in which Obama and the Democratic Congress of that time did it. So that's going to be a factor, and people are going to have to weigh that into the balance.
All right. We're expecting to hear soon from Rob Portman, the senator from Ohio, who was a favorite on the media favorite, at least on the short list, to be Romney's running mate. What do we expect to hear from him, and is he still a rising prospect in the party?
Well, it's definitely, Portman's profile, he's been around for decades, and I think he'll continue to be around. He's not necessarily Mr. Excitement. What I think we'll hear from him is similar to what we've heard previously in the evening and what we'll hear later, talking about the choice in this election, the choice and also America's position in the world, which the Republicans think is being endangered.
All right. We will bring you more coverage in just a moment. This is special coverage of the 2012 Republican National Convention from NPR News.